Welcome back to the NFL History Podcast. My name is Caleb. I'm your host, and I'm joined by Marcus and Tony. How are you guys doing today?
Doing pretty good.
Great.
That's awesome. Good to hear. I don't know about you guys, but I'm excited for this episode. The years we're going to be talking about are pretty fun in terms of professional football.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for it too.
Me too.
Awesome. Awesome. So before we kind of get into the meat of the episode, I just kind of wanted to recap what happened at the end of the last episode to kind of just bridge into what we're talking about today.
Good idea.
So to start on the recap, we are talking about the merger again today. Well, not quite the merger, a little bit more background for the merger. So last time we talked about the NFL from 1920 to about 1960. Today we're going to be talking from 1960 to about 1965. There might be a little bit before 1960 because the AFL was talked about before 1960. That's just the year it was officially formed.
Right.
So at the end of the last episode, the big event that we kind of ended on was the greatest game ever played in 1958, which was a big turning point in the NFL because after the 1958 NFL Championship, the greatest game ever played, the NFL would only become more successful in the future.
And yeah. Still.
Exactly. The success just keeps building for the NFL from 1958 till now, and it's still growing, obviously. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It was, you know, this great game. It was televised to 45 million people, and a lot of people saw it, and that's kind of when they fell in love with football, and like I said, it only became more popular. And like we said, Lamar Hunt was one of the people who watched that game, and he knew at that point that he wanted to become a franchise owner in the NFL. So that was a really big moment for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we left off. We talked about a little bit more, like Burt Bell dying, but we'll kind of get to that. We're going to start at the end of the greatest game ever played, so 1958, and then go from there, basically. Sound good?
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
Yes. I'm excited.
So, like I said, Lamar Hunt, after watching that game, really wanted to become a franchise owner. The NFL in 1958 has 12 teams in the league, and they don't want to expand. Like, they are really stable at this point, and they're starting to become more popular, like I said. And so they're really just trying to keep that core together, build a little bit more, and then maybe expand, but basically nobody really wants to expand at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So Lamar Hunt calls, and he was not the only person that called the NFL asking for an expansion. There were people from Miami, Buffalo, Seattle, New Orleans, Denver, Minneapolis, Houston, Orange counties like Los Angeles, Atlanta.
Right.
They all wanted expansions, franchises.
Yeah, all over.
You know, especially where the game is getting more popular and it's starting to become a financially viable option to become a franchise owner, whereas before, most people were losing money constantly. And basically, they would all call Burt Bell, and Burt Bell would be like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen because expansion teams needed unanimous approval by the owners.
Oh, wow.
And in 1958 and onward a little bit, there were two teams in Chicago still, the Chicago Bears and the Chicago Cardinals. Mm. The Chicago Bears were good. The Chicago Cardinals were not good, and they were losing money a lot because they were being completely overshadowed by the Bears. Yeah. So they didn't want to
Right.
So the owners of the Chicago Cardinals, it's the Wolfners now. It used to be the Bidwells. Charlie Bidwell was the original owner. Then he died, and Charlie Bidwell's widow married this guy named Wolfner. His last name is Wolfner. And
Right. So
they didn't want more franchises because they wanted to get a more profitable location.
Yeah, right? That makes sense.
But they also weren't really in a hurry to move either.
Okay.
So when all these people would call up Burt Bell, the commissioner, he would just say, okay, we'll call the Wolfners and see if he can, like, get their franchise from them, basically.
Right.
So that's what Lamar Hunt does, right? He calls up Burt Bell. Burt Bell says, call the Wolf Nurse. And Lamar Hunt calls the Wolf Nurse. And the Wolf Nurse kind of drag him along for like a year, right? Kind of toying with him, talking, negotiating a little bit. And then at the end of the year, they're like, oh, yeah, we're not going to sell you the franchise or anything. So Lamar Hunt's a little disappointed.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
You know, his dreams of being an NFL owner are basically, you know, gone at this point. But the thing is that when he was talking with the Wolf Nurse would keep on hinting at these other people who wanted to buy the franchise as well, right? So they didn't really need to sell to Lamar Hunt because they had other people to sell to who maybe had more money.
Yeah.
Even though Lamar Hunt was extremely rich. Like, he was crazy rich.
Where did Lamar Hunt get all his money from?
His dad was an oil tycoon in Texas.
Okay.
So he just got his dad's money.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
I mean, you gotta get your money from somewhere. Yeah. Right? Lamar Hunt actually tried working for his dad's oil business, and he ended up hating it. So that's why he quit, and then he found football after that.
Hmm.
Which I'm glad he did, because Lamar Hunt had a really big impact on the NFL.
And soccer in the U.S. That's, I think that's probably a little off topic, but he founded the MLS.
I did not know that. That's really interesting, actually. He actually had his finger in another baseball league at one time, which I'll talk about later.
He was one of the initial investors in the Chicago Bulls.
There you go.
Oh, really?
Lamar Hunt was talking to the Wolf Nurse. He was down in Miami talking to them, and they told him no. And so he was flying back to his home city of Dallas. And on the airplane, he realized, oh, wait, if there's all these people that are also trying to buy the Wolf Nurse franchise, maybe what I can do is start my own professional football league with these other people who want a franchise, and then we'll compete directly with the NFL. Everyone will get a football franchise, and we'll be able to tap into this market that's starting to really blow up.
Genius.
So on one plane ride, he sketched out the whole entire idea for a league. Very detailed.
Okay. Huh.
You know, in terms of like financial plans, player plans, you know, potential franchises, all this stuff. It's, you know, just on one plane ride. He was really into it.
Nice, yeah.
So the first person he calls up is Bud Adams from Houston, who also wanted a franchise. So they're the two big names. Lamar Hunt, number one. Bud Adams, number two.
Mm-hmm.
And Lamar Hunt, the other thing is that he was extremely rich. And he was also extremely polite.
Nice.
And so he, even though he wanted to start another league, he also was very hesitant to, because he didn't want to step on the NFL's toes in any way. So for about another year, he kept on calling the NFL and was like, okay, are you sure you can't get me an expansion franchise? No. And, you know, they constantly told him no. And so he just kept on moving forward with the AFL idea very slowly, making sure that he had pursued all the avenues with the NFL in terms of expansion.
Hmm.
That's interesting.
Yep.
I would have thought he would have just jumped on board.
Right. And it kind of might seem like a little deceptive, like he was maybe trying to get into the NFL still and maybe crossing the people that he was trying to start this, you know, competing right. league with, but yeah. It wasn't deceptive. It was just him. It was just his personality, basically. And yeah. he never wanted to double cross any of these other people, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, he has Bud Adams, and then he figures out that these other potential owners, there's one in Minnesota, one in Denver, one in LA, and one in New York, basically. And then he goes to Burt Bell, the commissioner, one more time, and you know, is his final, I guess, inquiry, attempt to get a franchise. Burt Bell says, no, you have to talk to the Wolf Nurse first. And so that's when Lamar Hunt's all right, full steam ahead. So Hunt sends an ambassador person over to Bell, and he does it anonymously. And Burt Bell's like, okay, great, start another league. That's actually a really good idea. So that's kind of funny coming from the commissioner in the NFL.
Yeah.
He was actually really supportive of the new league. He was really excited for it, and he really wanted it to succeed.
Hmm.
That is surprising, because you'd think they have like monopoly right now.
Exactly. Part of the reason he was excited about this new league is because Burt Bell had to go and testify in front of Congress about the NFL not being a monopoly, basically. Yeah. And so he actually asks this ambassador if, so Burt Bell asks the ambassador if the Burt Bell can go to Congress and say, oh yeah, there's a new league being formed, we don't have a monopoly, there's going to be a competition, basically.
Yeah.
Because the U.S. does have anti-monopoly laws.
Yeah.
And so, they give him the green light. Burt Bell goes in front of Congress and basically pitches the idea of a second football league to Congress, and is really convincing about it and says, you know, this is going to be awesome for football because football is such an awesome sport. People are going to want to watch it, and it's going to be really good for the NFL in the long run. Which a lot of people didn't believe, because when the AAFC was around, which you talked about last episode, the owners basically lost their minds about it. But Burt Bell knew that it was good for the league in the long run, and so he expected the same thing from the AFL.
Yeah.
Visionary.
Yeah. And so Burt Bell is not only supportive, but he would give Lamar Hunt advice for the new league specifically.
Really?
So he's like, Lamar Hunt has, at this point, 6 owners lined up, and Burt Bell says, well, get 8 owners, you know, to start the league, because it'll make things a lot easier for you in terms of scheduling and like a championship game.
Yeah.
And he gave them the NFL charter bylaws, so the AFL could write their own charter. So he was really, really supportive. And so on August 3rd, 1959, the AFL announced that they were going to organize and start playing 1 year from then in 1960. Mm-hmm. On August 3rd, the AFL was announced. On August 21st, so 18 days after the AFL was announced, the NFL announced that they would be expanding.
Hmm.
And the two cities that they were most likely going to expand to were Dallas, which is where Lamar Hunt was going to start his franchise, and Houston, which is where Bud Adams was going to start his franchise. So you can see what the NFL is trying to accomplish here.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They're trying to offer / compete with, you know, Lamar Hunt and Bud Adams, the two big names in the AFL.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And if they can get Lamar Hunt on board with the NFL expansion and Bud Adams on board with an expansion team, then the AFL will just kind of dissolve. They'll make these two people happy, and then they probably won't have to expand again for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that leadership will be gone.
Right.
So this is kind of the thing where, you know, it may have seemed like Lamar Hunt was trying to be sneaky about getting into the NFL when he was working on the AFL. But from this point on, he never even considers the idea of taking that Dallas franchise in the NFL. He sticks with the AFL through thick and thin from this point on.
Smart.
Nice.
And then, like we said, in the 1959 season at an Eagles game, Burt Bell dies, which left a big hole in the NFL, but because he was such a strong commissioner for the NFL, but also hurt the AFL because now they lose this guiding mentor presence as well.
Yeah.
Because Burt Bell really wanted the AFL to succeed because he knew it was going to be good for the NFL.
Yeah.
And then the AFL finds its last two franchises, one in Buffalo and one in Boston. So this is actually one of my favorite things kind of about looking at history, is you kind of get to see where the teams come from.
Yeah.
Because the AFC and the NFC in the modern NFL are based on the original NFL AFL.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah.
So the teams in the NFC are basically from the original NFL. The teams from the AFC are basically from the original AFL. So you kind of see,
and then expansion teams kind of filling in.
Yeah, exactly. So you kind of see, you know, Houston, Denver, Los Angeles, New York. You can just draw the lines between the teams, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here are the 8 teams. Ready?
Ready.
The Boston Patriots.
Yep.
The Denver Broncos. The Houston Oilers. The Dallas Texans. The Oakland Raiders. The Los Angeles Chargers, the New York Titans, and the Buffalo Bills.
And the Titans became the Jets later?
Yep. The Dallas Texans later become the Chiefs in Kansas City. Okay. And the Houston Oilers later become the Tennessee Titans.
Huh.
Right.
Which, I mean, those don't all happen soon. But
they eventually. Happen.
Yeah. And then, so I don't know if you guys remember the names I said before, but one city left off that list that was in the original plans for the AFL is Minnesota.
The reason city of for Minnesota? This is
because, well, Minneapolis, Minnesota. So the reason for this is there were owners in Minnesota who were ready to have a franchise in the AFL, but then the NFL came to the Minnesota owners and said, hey, why don't you come into the NFL? And the Minnesota people, on the night of the draft...
Of the AFL draft or NFL?
Of the AFL draft.
Gotcha.
So when they're going to choose their first players for the first teams for the first year,
yeah,
Minnesota finalized the deal to join the NFL. And somebody came in to the meeting, like, because all the AFL owners were meeting, and basically, you know, said, this guy betrayed us. He's going to the NFL.
Judas.
Yeah. So at that point, they had to find another owner, and they found somebody in Oakland to take up that eighth spot. Something interesting about the draft is because nobody had personnel departments at that point, you know, the AFL had only been around for, you know, a few months yeah. when they first drafted. Basically, they had one or like a handful of scouts go out and just make like a master ranking list, and then they just kind of went down the list and just gave players to each person.
Wow. I mean,
yeah, so
it makes sense at the time. It's kind of crazy from now. Every team has a crazy big scouting department. They know yeah. every player.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, you know, with no scouting department, it was basically just like, all right, let's just get some people on the team. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the AFL and the NFL also had an unwritten rule that they wouldn't poach each other's players when they were already signed.
Okay.
So it was either veterans who were cut or rookies, whoever could sign the rookie.
Hmm.
Right, but if a player was on the team, they wouldn't be signed by the other league, basically.
Yeah.
Gotcha, yeah, yeah.
And then the first game was played on September 19th, 1960, between the Boston Patriots and the Denver Broncos. And even getting to that point for the AFL was a huge win. Because once before the NFL was planning on expanding, it seemed like a great idea to have, you know, all these new cities brought into the professional football network. But once the NFL opened its doors to expansion and, you know, laid out plans to expand within the next couple of years, people started to really doubt the AFL is actually going to happen.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's like, oh, well, where you had a competitive edge, now it's gone because those cities could... you know, have NFL teams here in a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But they kept on pushing. They got their first game in 1960. And that's also the year that the Dallas Cowboys came into the league in 1960. And then the Minnesota Vikings came in 1961. And then the NFL had plans to expand in the next few years as well, up to some more teams.
Huh. So after refusing to let them expand... they go start their own league, and then the NFL says, okay, we'll expand now.
Yep, exactly. So at the beginning of the 1960 NFL season, when they're doing the owners' meetings, they have to choose a new commissioner. And in order to pass a vote on a new commissioner, 9 of the 12 owners need to vote for the same person. So a 75% vote.
Oh, wow.
So it's not quite unanimous.
But a pretty big majority.
Yeah, it's a big majority, so it's hard. So there were two potential candidates that came out in the beginning. One was the former treasurer for the NFL under Burt Bell, and one was the San Francisco 49ers lawyer at the time.
Hmm.
And the issues were, so they each had their pros and cons, right? The pros for the treasurer were that he was going to be like Burt Bell. Everyone loved Burt Bell and the way he ran the NFL. But the problem is that he was never going to be as good as Burt Bell.
Uh-huh. Does he have a name?
The treasurer is Austin Gunsell. And the lawyer is Marshall Leahy.
Neither of those names sound like commissioner names.
Yeah.
No, they're terrible names.
They're not qualified. Names.
Yeah, so those were the two potential candidates. So Austin Gunsell, the ex-treasurer, his pros were that he would run the NFL like Burt Bell. The con was is that he would not be nearly as effective as Burt Bell was. Right. And so even though he'd have the same policies, he would not be nearly as good of a commissioner. And so people liked and didn't like that aspect of him, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then Marshall Leahy, the lawyer from the San Francisco 49ers, would probably be a good commissioner. But the problem is that he wanted to move the offices to San Francisco because that's where his family was. At the time, the offices were in Philadelphia, where Burt Bell lived. And a lot of these old school owners who started the NFL in the Midwest, right?
Yeah.
You know, in the Ohio area.
Yep.
Did not want the offices to be that far west, basically. And so they didn't like that idea. And it basically came down to eight of the owners would vote for San Francisco. Then, like, three people would vote for the ex-treasurer, Gunsell. And then one person would abstain. This went on for literally days.
Huh.
Just nobody changing their opinions?
Yeah. Dozens of votes, and the votes always had the same result. They would vote multiple times a day after arguing for hours, and it would just be the same thing constantly, right?
That's awesome.
Some people didn't want to move west, and the other people didn't want to have this other commissioner in, and it was terrible. So finally, Dan Reeves, who was the Rams owner, and Wellington Mara, who was a part owner with his brother of the Giants, came together and were like, look, neither of these guys is ever going to become commissioner because no one's going to change their votes.
Uh-huh.
We need to figure out someone new to become. We need to figure out like a new candidate.
Yeah.
That people can agree on. And so they start talking and they start throwing out some names. One of the names that got thrown out was Vince Lombardi, who had become the Packers coach by then. And he had actually been successful with the Packers. But we'll talk about him. We'll talk about him a little bit later. That wasn't going to work for, you know, reasons, I guess, because he was kind of a polarizing figure.
Yeah.
So after going through some people, they eventually came to the current GM of the Rams, who was named Pete Rozelle. And they both decided that he was most likely the best candidate to be able to get people to agree to vote on him. Right?
Nice.
Yeah.
Pete Rozelle was only 33 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, he was a GM, which is pretty young for a GM, it feels like, too.
It is. Yeah, it's really young. Yeah, so he was the youngest GM in the league at the time, at 33.
That'd pretty much be like Sean McVay becoming the commissioner right now.
Yeah, it just seems kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Crazy, yeah.
So basically, Dan Reeves and Wellington Mara go to Pete Rozelle and they're like, hey, we would like you to become commissioner. We're thinking about nominating you to become commissioner for the NFL. And Pete Rozelle was, you know, surprised, to say the least. It came out of nowhere. And he basically said, look, I don't want to be nominated and then just get rejected, right?
Yeah.
That'd just be embarrassing. And they're like, don't worry. We'll make sure we get all the owners on board before we even nominate you or vote, right? And we'll make sure that you're going to pass before we continue down this path. So they start talking to owners and they're like, hey, we have this, you know, third candidate who would be probably better than either of these people. And then some of the owners were just like, yeah, as long as it's not this other guy, I'm happy.
Right
Like, that's how frustrated they were. I mean, and you would be frustrated if you've been working trying to vote on this thing for days and nothing
changing.
Nobody
can agree.
Yeah.
And so they eventually, you know, get enough owners that agree that they would vote for Pete. And so they send Pete out of the meetings and like, okay, you know, just wait. And at this time, like I said, the NFL is getting more popular. A lot of reporters were actually at these owner meetings, right?
Right.
Not in the meetings themselves, but in the lobby of the hotel they are meeting at. Because they, you know, at that time, the sports or the coverage for football is going up. So they, you know, were getting the stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they're hungry for stories. And so Pete Rozelle knows he can't go back to the lobby or else he's just going to get, you know, bombarded by reporters. So he decides to go to the bathroom and just kind of stand there.
Nice.
And basically what would happen is whenever someone would come into the bathroom, he would just start washing his hands, right? And then he would wash his hands until the person left. And then he stopped washing his hands and just stand there again. I think it said that he estimated that he washed his hands about 35 times in like half an hour while he was standing there because he just wanted to seem like a regular person, you know, and not draw any attention to himself.
Yeah.
So the people would walk in, he'd start washing his hands, they'd use the bathroom, wash yep. their hands, and then walk yep. out, and the whole time yep. he'd be washing his hands.
I guess so.
That's funny.
Yeah. It's a pretty funny story.
That's awesome.
So then one of the owners comes in and he's like, all right, you know, you're the new commissioner. Why don't you
comes into the bathroom?
Yeah.
Nice.
So he's like, you know, come back to the meeting. And so the first words that Pete Rozelle says is, I can honestly say I come to you with clean hands.
Nice.
Which is an awesome line considering what he, you know, had just been doing for the last half hour.
Yeah. That'd be funny. Standing there, door opens. He hurry and turns on the water. Hey, you're the new commissioner.
Yeah, he goes turn on the water.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Some people who were reporting on the NFL thought that Pete Rozelle was kind of just a figurehead, a mouthpiece for the owners, right?
Okay, yeah.
And that he wasn't going to be very forceful as a commissioner, which was proven false. He actually did a lot of things early in his career that helped define him as a commissioner. One of the big things is there was a big gambling scandal in like 1960, 1961, where players were betting on games, which was against the rules.
Right.
For obvious reasons, because then of course. You could stray into, you know, point shaving and stuff like that. Pete Rozelle gets wind of this and he launches an investigation, right? And he takes his time, makes sure he gets all the facts, you know, tries to keep the media out of it as much as possible. And then eventually ends up suspending two players and fining like a lot of other players. And it just kind of solidified his status as commissioner because he wielded those commissioner powers, right? After investigating, he suspended and fined players. And he also showed that he was more about the league than about individual players or teams, right?
Yeah.
And the other big thing is that he was supported by like the coaches and the owners in this situation as well. And so that kind of set his career on a track of being a successful commissioner, basically.
Right, right.
And the thing about this gambling scandal is that none of the players actually bet against their team. They only bet on their own team. So they're still playing hard.
Yeah.
But where, you know, gambling is, you know, against the rules for players.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're betting on yourself, you can't do that.
Exactly. So he still, you know, had to discipline them. And like I said, you know, it's something that the NFL could have just kind of swept under the rug a little bit and just kind of tried to hide. But, you know, he came forward and he just showed like, you know, the NFL is a seriously, we care about fair competition. This is what we're going to do about it. You know? Yeah. So it was a really big step for him.
Mm-hmm.
Another career defining moment was not necessarily as well received for Pete Rozelle, but it was still defining in the fact that it happened, I guess, and it was a big deal. And that's when in 1963 John F. Kennedy was assassinated in November, so it was during the football season.
Mm-hmm.
And Pete Rozelle struggled with, you know, the decision of whether or not to cancel games that week for the NFL.
Yeah.
And it was really hard because it's like, you know, do we continue doing this where, you know, football is an important thing to culture and people would, you know, be able to try and take their mind off this terrible thing that's happened?
Yeah.
Or do we cancel it in respect for the president? Yeah. Right? An almost impossible decision to make. And Pete Rozelle decides to not cancel the games, which ended up being a terrible decision in terms of public relations. But, you know, and that's kind of the point in his career where he faced a lot of criticism, but he was able to handle it like a pro And he was able to move on and kind of still guide the NFL through that public relations nightmare, basically. Those early events kind of helped shape Pete Rozelle's career, and it proved that he was going to do things a little bit differently than Burt Bell had done them, and that he was not a figurehead for the owners, but he was going to help guide the owners to a successful, you know, league and successful years to come in the NFL.
Yeah.
So the first few years in the 60s were actually big growth spurts for the NFL. So the 58 championship game was, you know, where the NFL started growing in popularity, and then the next 5 years were really big steps. And there were quite a few reasons for those big steps. One of those is because there was this guy named Ed Sable. I don't know if you guys have heard of that name before.
Of course, NFL Films.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So, I guess a little bit of background. The NFL used to hire production companies to come in and film championship games and then make like 30-minute highlight reels of the games, right?
Yeah. Right.
And so they sent out like an open bid for the 1962 championship game. And Ed Sable had like a one man, basically like out of his garage, film production company. And he decided to put in a bid for the 1962 championship game for the NFL for like $5,000. So not a lot of money. I mean, it was back then, right?
Yeah.
I think the next highest bid is like $2,500, and like that. And he knew that was the next highest bid, so he really wanted to do this game.
Right. Yeah.
$2,500 or $25,000.
$2,500. Okay. So $2,500.
And he then bid $5,000.
$5,000.
Okay. Yeah.
So twice as much as the next highest bid.
Okay.
And so Ed Sable goes out there. He has like, you know, a few cameras, and he basically produces what Pete Rozelle called the greatest football film that Pete Rozelle had ever seen.
Nice.
That's Pete Rozelle's quote.
Hmm.
And so then Ed Sable, right after impressing like Pete Rozelle and the other people in the NFL so much, he makes the highlight films for the next two championship games. And then he goes to Pete Rozelle and says, hey, look, I have this idea where the NFL takes on my little production company, takes it internal, makes it a little bit bigger, and they basically send out crews to every game of the season, right? So that we can get all of this video footage documented and in-house for the NFL.
Yeah.
And we'll call it NFL Films.
Nice.
And this is actually something that I think is really big for the NFL, because now the NFL has so much footage, even from older games in the 60s, right?
Right.
And it really helps document the history of the NFL.
Yeah.
Right? Because like, you can watch like old, you know, Vince Lombardi, like clips of him walking around on the sidelines.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That's huge.
Right, and stuff like the early Super Bowls and stuff, because Ed Sable was, you know, had enough of a vision where he says, oh, if we do this right, it's going to make a big difference for the NFL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I actually think that this is one of the biggest steps for the NFL, is making NFL films so early in their history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously like 40 years after they're founded, but still. Because, I mean, I don't want to sound like rude or anything, but I don't think any other major sports league is as well video documented as football is.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I really like that about the NFL.
Yeah, definitely.
So as we're talking here about kind of the growth of the NFL, I think Marcus, you did some research on one of the most spectacular players of that era. Of all time, you know. So, and someone who helped bring popularity to the NFL. So why don't you kind of talk us through what you learned.
Yeah, so if you guys hadn't already guessed, that player was Jim Brown. He was a running back for the Cleveland Browns, and he played for 9 years. He was drafted 6th overall in 1957, and he had quite the career, let me tell you. First of all, a somewhat big milestone is that he made the Pro Bowl every single season of his 9-year career.
Wow.
Nice. That's pretty cool.
That's an impressive stat, actually.
Yeah. He was also a 3-time MVP during his career. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 9 years. That's pretty crazy.
That's, yeah. And especially for a running back.
Yeah. And so those are both two pretty big feats to show just how big of an impactful player he was on the NFL. Also, during his career, he led the league in rushing 8 of his 9 seasons. So wow. he was consistently dominant throughout his career. He's the only player in NFL history to average 100-plus yards a game for his career.
Oh, my gosh.
That's crazy.
He averaged 104.3 yards a game.
Nice.
Holy cow, that's crazy.
And that averages out to 5.2 yards a carry, which is the second best among running backs. So really just proves how dominant he was. He set a lot of records, and he was also very confident in himself. Someone who remained unnamed said that he told him that on Sundays that he became a god and that nobody could stop him, nobody could hurt him, and there was no one comparable to him.
Nice.
And so
I would actually agree with that statement. I don't know if you guys have seen any Jim Brown highlights.
Yeah.
But yeah. He would just walk over people, basically.
Yeah, seriously.
They would try to tackle me, just like shove them aside and just keep running.
Yeah.
Like he's crazy to watch.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like he's playing against, kids or something. He really does just push people aside and keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And. In his rookie year, he really set himself as a dominant running back. In his 9th game of his career, he set the league record for rushing yards in a single game with 237 yards.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So, he was pretty good. He also set the single season rushing record with 1,527 yards in just 12 games. Back then, it wasn't 16 games like it is now. Right. But so in 12 games, 1,500 yards is...
Oh, my gosh. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Although, how dominant he was, he only had one NFL championship in 1964. But after that, he started to dip his toes in other ponds, I guess you could say, and he started acting.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so... While he was filming his second movie in London after his 9th regular season, the movie was called The Dirty Dozen, and it fell behind schedule. And so he made the decision to stick around set instead of returning to training camp on time. And the owner didn't really like that, and so he made the decision that for every day Jim Brown was not at training camp, he would fine him $1,000. And so, so Jim Brown said, "You know what? I'll just retire." And he called it a career after 9 years and pursued an acting career.
That's crazy. That's how he ended up retiring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was fully planning on going back to training camp right after they finished filming the movie, and then he just called it a career because the owner decided to fine him.
Wow.
I mean, you talk about players retiring early, and people that come to mind are like Barry Sanders, but he even played for 10 years.
Yeah.
So, which is one more than Jim Brown played for.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah, I wouldn't have ever thought that's the reason he retired. You'd have thought then if he threatened to retire or something, then the owner would be like, okay, never mind.
Yeah. Yep, he didn't even give him a chance to do that. He held a press conference on set a couple hours after the owner announced that and said, I'm done.
Huh.
Yeah, but regardless, he solidified himself and NFL history and secured himself a spot in the Hall of Fame. The Browns retired his number, and when he retired, he had 2,359 carries for 12,312 yards and 106 touchdowns on the ground, which all three were NFL records at the time.
Dang.
So needless to say, he was pretty dominant and brought a lot of fans to football, I'd say.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome, Marcus.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing that.
No problem.
So as we're talking about kind of, drawing fans to the game, another move, like a public PR move that the NFL made at the time was something called the Playoff Bowl. And I think Tony wanted to talk about that a little bit, so why don't you go for it?
Yeah, so The playoff bowl was established in 1960 by the NFL, and it was basically a third place game. So you had the Eastern and Western conferences in the NFL, and the winners of each conference with the best record during the regular season played in the championship, and then the losers played in this game. And so the reason they did this was because, like you said, they wanted to get more recognition, because during the regular season, they didn't have very many games on TV, and of course they had the championship, but then they wanted another one to show off this. Like they were saying, they have superior talent. They wanted to show that off, so they made this playoff bowl. But it was also called the Burt Bell Benefit Bowl, which obviously we talked about Burt Bell quite a bit so far. And so what they did was they would take part of the money revenue from this game and donate it to the Burt Bell Players Pension Fund. Which this was like the first time the NFL ever really did anything to like support former players. Like now, obviously it's a pretty big deal with all the CTE and all that, but this was really the first time they created any sort of pension or anything like that.
Oh, that's really cool.
So yeah, this game was played in the Orange Bowl in Miami every year. And it was not that great of a game, really. Like, so it did, it like doubled the teams in the postseason for the NFL, which was cool.
Right. Yeah.
But really, the NFL didn't even count it as an official postseason game. Well, they counted them as exhibition games. So, like, the stats from these games don't really count.
So,
I mean, there wasn't, I don't think there was really ever too much of an incentive for the teams to really play as hard as they could or really wanted to win. And I mean, as eventually, like as the playoffs expanded, as they added more teams, the Dolphins joined the AFL in 1966 in Miami. So, and this game was played in Miami. So, I mean, the interest is just declining because, I mean, nobody wants to really see players play in a game they don't really care about. That doesn't really count.
Yeah.
And then the game was eventually canceled before the 1970 season, which was going to be the first merge season, which we'll get to. But at that point, there was going to be seven postseason games, including the championship, an all-star game. And they were like, we're having this new league, basically. We don't want a loser's bowl
in it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But it was pretty widely criticized. One of the biggest critics was Vince Lombardi. So the Packers won NFL titles in 61 and 62. Then 63 and 64, they played in this playoff bowl. And Vince Lombardi called it to his players, well, to censor it, the crap bowl. And he says it was a loser's bowl for losers.
Well, and, yeah, I mean, where Vince Lombardi, you know, won a lot of championships, I'm sure he was not happy that he was playing for third place, basically.
If you're not first, you're last.
Yeah, and that's that is what he said, basically. He used second instead, but he said second's basically the first loser. There's no point to do this. Yeah. He won another quote. He said, it's a hinky-dink football game held in a hinky-dink town played by hinky-dink players. That's all second place is, hinky-dink.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So, yeah, he didn't like it. And the Packers, I mean, they didn't lose. With Vince Lombardi, they didn't lose very much in the postseason, but they did lose the 1964 playoff game.
Playoff bowl.
Because, I mean, they probably didn't really care. There was a bunch of coaches that in this game would extend players' curfews out, and a lot of players just kind of saw it as a vacation because, back then, not too many people would get to go to Miami.
Yeah.
And so a lot of players just kind of saw it as we're going on a vacation here. And then another kind of funny thing, there's a all-pro defensive tackle named Roger Brown. And so this playoff bowl lasted 10 years, 1960 to 1969, and he played in five of them.
What? So they, like, changed teams halfway through or something?
Yes, yes. So it was the most by any player, and he won each time, which is, I mean, that's good for him. But
that's cool.
So he played for the Lions from 1960 to 1962, and they played in it 3 years in a row. And they won them all. They also are the team that has won the most playoff bowls.
Okay.
Which that's they're three and oh. So yeah, so it's like they were third place the most from 1960 and 1969. And then he played for the Los Angeles Rams 1967-1969. And okay. he said that playing in those seemingly meaningless contests was like having the worst inferiority complex of all time. He said, I was in five of them, and to have played in it five in the 10 years it was in existence is absolutely pitiful.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, people didn't really like this game.
Yeah.
And so it's not very surprising it was removed. Although they did get paid for it in... The first 4 years, the winning team got $600, the losers got $400. Then the fifth year, the winners got $800, the losers got $600. And then the rest of the year, 6 through 10, the winners got $1,200 and the losers got $500.
Okay, that's not bad.
So, I mean, they at least got paid for it. But it's kind of like now you see the Pro Bowl. You get paid to be in it or whatever, but a lot of players still don't really want to do it.
Yeah.
Even though it's in Hawaii or whatever, you see players skipping it all the time. But there was kind of a legacy thing that remained for a little while from this playoff bowl, you could say. So the losers from the conference championships from 1980 to 2009, the coaching staffs of those losing teams would be the coaches for the Pro Bowl.
Oh.
So there's kind of parallels there. Mm-hmm. But then in 2010, they switched it up, and then it was the coaches were from the team with the winningest record in the regular season on each side that lost in the divisional round.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's not a game that very many people liked, but it was meant to kind of improve, try to get the NFL on TV more. And so it did accomplish that, but yeah, players and coaches didn't really like it. This was in 1967, the Browns were going to play in this game. And they had two players, Fred Hoagland and Ernie Kellerman. And so these were so Hoagland was the team center, Kellerman was the strong safety. And they were golfing buddies, they golfed all season. And so they were like, okay. So there was 2 weeks between this game and the regular season. So they're the end of the regular season. So they're like, we'll go down there early and we'll golf and we'll get into So they got somebody to get them into the Mayfield Country Club to golf. Uh-huh. This was like a friend of Kellerman's that was a pro golfer. And he said basically this golfer is from Cleveland too, and he was in Miami golfing. He said if they drove his car down, then he would get them into this country club to golf.
Uh-huh.
So they drove 1,200 miles to get down there. Then they were there. They went golfing with this guy. And then the boxer Rocky Marciano, which he's super. He was a 2-time heavyweight champion,
right?
All that stuff. And then Kellerman, at first didn't recognize him, didn't know. But then Hoagland was like, "No, this guy is the best boxer ever," or whatever.
Right.
But then both of them later said that they didn't even remember what the result of the game was. What they remember from that week was golfing with this guy, this boxer. That's
funny.
That was their highlight. They didn't care about whatever happened in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
so
funny.
It was an interesting little game they had for a little while. And, I mean, if they have a third-place game now, I don't think I would watch it. I don't think players would want to play. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a bad consolation prize.
Yeah, exactly.
Not make the Super Bowl. Some other things that happened in the early 60s is NFL merchandising. Kind of started, I guess, in the late 50s and early 60s. So it started with the NFL or the Los Angeles Rams in the late 50s. They started making, shirts and hats and stuff that would, have the Rams logo on it, basically, so people could show their support that way.
Uh-huh.
And then all the NFL teams ended up hiring the same company that did the merchandising for the Rams in 1959. And then 1963, the NFL took that merchandising company, in-house and started making consistent merchandising for all teams so that, fans could get into the game more. And so that was another way to help grow the NFL.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge now.
Yeah, exactly.
You can get NFL gear merchandise from like anywhere practically.
Yeah, exactly. And the NFL still has their in-house merchandising people too.
Yep. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Another thing that happened is the NFL hired a stat company to start professionally keeping track of their stats.
Oh wow.
Right? And then they'd be able to send out stats to hundreds and hundreds of newspapers instead of just like a handful of newspapers, and the stats were more accurate. And it that helped because then people could look in the newspaper and see, oh yeah, here's the box score from this game I wasn't able to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And so that helped boost the popularity that way as well.
Yeah, smart.
And then another thing that happened was the Hall of Fame was founded in 1963. The Hall of Fame didn't really gain traction as much until a couple decades later, but it was still a big step, right? It kind of gave players, you know, kind of a career goal, I guess, is to be in the Hall of Fame eventually. And then I think one of the biggest things that happened in these few years at the beginning of the 60s is the NFL completely changed the way that they handled their TV deals. So a little bit of background. In 1952, this guy in baseball came to all the owners in Major League Baseball and said, hey, we need to start splitting television profits. Because this was a time period when all teams in all major sports would do their television contracts independently with the local TV stations. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, the people in New York would get a lot more money for their television contract because a lot more people would watch a New York game, right? Because there are more people living there than, you know, in a small town. And so this guy came and he said, okay, let's split the TV revenues 50-50. You know, the home team gets 50% of the television contract for that game, and the visiting team gets 50% of the contract. And that's only for the game that they played in.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the baseball owners shot it down because they're like, oh, it's, you know, too communist, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
I mean, this is right in the Cold War era. So, you know, communists were actually, you know, something that people were scared of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this idea, you know, became public through, like, you know, I guess notes from the owners' meetings in those baseball and that, you know, Major League Baseball from that year. And Burt Bell actually read this, and he knew that this was something that NFL would actually need to implement in the future, but they don't implement it yet.
Right.
So then this same idea is actually proposed in this startup baseball league that was being made to rival Major League Baseball to force them to expand, basically, because Major League Baseball hasn't expanded in a lot longer than the NFL hasn't expanded.
Yeah.
Right.
And so Lamar Hunt, he actually was a minority owner in this baseball league that was starting up. So this is where he got the idea from. And the idea was changed a little bit where it was a 33%, 67% split, where 33% of the contract, you know, the revenues would go to the home team, and then 67% will go into a league-wide pool, which would then be split evenly between all the teams in the league.
Hmm.
Okay.
Lamar Hunt, when he gets the owners together for the AFL, he proposes the idea, but once again, changed a little bit. Right?
Right.
Sorry, I guess I should finish up this other story. The baseball league didn't actually come to fruition because Major League Baseball ended up expanding because of that league. So then there wasn't a need for the league, and it just kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
So Lamar Hunt is, you know, organizing the AFL, and he proposes this deal to the owners of the AFL and says, all TV, it'll be a league deal with a TV network, right? And then that revenue will be split among the teams evenly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So nothing specific for the home team or the away team. It's just the league will do one deal with a TV company, right? They'll negotiate for the entire league, and then they'll split the profits. And all eight owners were completely happy with that agreement, actually.
Yeah.
No one fought it, and they just decided, yeah, let's do it.
Nice.
And so Lamar Hunt was able to propose a deal with ABC, actually, which ended up helping the AFL a lot. where, you know, they just got, you know, a certain amount of money, and then they just split it evenly.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1960 season, the AFL, right, its first season, every single team would be guaranteed the same amount of money from TV revenues, at least. But the big selling point was that those eight teams would be making more than five NFL teams were making from television revenues at the time.
Wow.
Yeah. Because you have people like, you know, the New York Giants or the Rams who are making, you know, over $100,000 a year. And then people in Green Bay who are making like $5,000 a year from television revenues, right?
Yeah.
And so this kind of changed the way that professional football structured its contracts with television.
Yeah.
So the NFL adopts the same idea, the league-wide TV package in 1961. And it kind of comes down to the idea that in a major league, you know, major sports league, you want the competition to be on the field, right? Yeah. Not off the field. And so by evenly distributing these television revenues between all the teams, it would help level the playing field. And it's a really revolutionary concept, and I think it kind of sets the path for the NFL, where the NFL, in my opinion at least, is one of the most balanced leagues in major sports today because of things like the draft, which was, you know, established in the 30s, and this TV deal, and then like the hard salary cap.
What's interesting too is, so all the merchandise, like all, if you go to an NFL shop, whatever, it doesn't matter how many popular players a team has, they split all that revenue between all the teams as well.
Right, really? And it's the same thing. It helps balance the NFL, like I said, it balances the NFL, where now Green Bay is making the same amount of money as New York or Los Angeles, these big TV markets. And then it kind of, what helped drive this point home is Vince Lombardi coming to Green Bay and taking that small market team and taking him to championship game after championship game after championship game, right?
Uh-huh.
So now you see the small town market team dominating the NFL, and it's like, okay, this is, you know, an even league, basically.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And so I mean, then...
I think you still see that today, obviously. Like, every year you have a team that any team can win pretty much every year. You know, this year, obviously, the 49ers are great. Last year, they weren't that good.
Yep.
You know, every year, it seems like every team has a shot.
Yep, exactly. But then in a sport like, I don't want to...
No, do it.
Go too much off here, but like, one of my biggest gripes with something like baseball is teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Red Sox have a huge advantage over these other teams because, you know, there's like soft salary caps and stuff.
Yeah. But, and they make the most, they can pay the most.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. And then, you know, kind of takes that competition off the field, you know, which isn't something that I agree with in professional sports.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So then, in 1964 was a huge moment for NFL and TV because, you know, from 1958 on, TV was only growing for the NFL, right? The NFL was learning how to televise its sport better, right?
Yeah.
You know, to make it better watching for the audience. And it's a great sport on television, I think. And so the NFL in 1964 sent out, you know, an open bid basically to all the major networks and said, okay, you know, send us your high bid, your offer for the season, right? And then we'll, you know, give it to the highest bidder basically.
Yeah, like a silent auction.
Yeah, exactly. CBS offered them $14.1 million per season.
Wow.
And it was basically three times as much as their last deal, which was only 2 years prior.
Wow.
Dang.
Yeah. Like, that's how big of a market it was.
Yeah, grew really quick.
Yeah. The AFL actually ended up making a deal that same year where... they would be making $7.5 million a year. But the biggest thing about that big difference is that the $14 million was split between 14 teams.
Right.
The $7.5 was split between 8. So if you look at the numbers, the AFL actually gained ground in that deal because they were making, on a per-team basis, not as much, but almost as much as the NFL.
Yeah.
So that was actually a big win for the AFL at that point.
I have something that I kind of found that I would like to talk about.
Yeah. Go for it.
So, in 1962, fantasy football was invented.
Really?
By Wilfred Wickenbach and Bill Tunnell. So they were they worked for the Raiders, and they were on like a road trip or whatever for one of their games, and the team was really bad. Like this year, they were the Raiders were 1-13 this year.
Ooh.
And so, and of course, they were in the AFL. The Raiders were. So, these guys wanted to make something that was where you didn't have to worry about or didn't have to think about as much as how bad their team was. They could just think about something else. And so they kind of like adopted these rules in this hotel that then were used for the next season for this league.
Right.
So the first league, there's still this league today. It's the GOPPPL, which is the Greater Oakland Professional Pigskin Prognosticators League.
What the heck?
Yeah, so it was formed in 1963, and they had on their rosters, they had, you could have two quarterbacks, four halfbacks, two fullbacks, four offensive ends or tight ends, two kick slash punt returners, two field goal kickers, two defensive backs and linebackers, two defensive linemen.
Oh my gosh, that's complicated.
So yeah, there was a lot. And so there was originally eight teams as part of this first season. I mean, of course, obviously they kept track of everything on hand. One of these members of this league was Ron Wolf, who at the time was a Raiders scout and later became the general manager for the Packers. And he's in the Packers Hall of Fame.
Cool.
But it was pretty crazy that this first... this started out just this tiny little thing. So they had the first draft in just in Wickenbach's house in 1963. And the first pick was George Blanda because he could score points as both. He played for the Houston Oilers, and he was a quarterback and a kicker.
Yep.
So he could score points. Then the second pick, the guy we talked about a little earlier, Jim Brown, was second.
Yep. Good pick.
So there was just there was only eight teams, and now it's transformed into, I mean,
millions something of people crazy. Play.
Yeah, and they have all kinds of different leagues now. Yep. You know, dynasty leagues or whatever, just year to year, auction drafts, just everything you can think of, you know, started from these guys because their team, the Raiders, sucked. And so they came up with this.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm sure they maybe got their ideas from fantasy baseball, which I think
was around a little bit before.
But, I mean, still, that's really cool that that was invented then. I mean, I don't think it was probably very popular in the 60s, but...
No, it probably didn't. It picked up popularity more in, like, 1985 because that's when they first became... That's when these football, fantasy football leagues became available online.
Oh, right.
One of the bigger ones, but, I mean, yeah, it'd be... I mean, think about now. It's so easy to do them. It'd be tough to take your... fantasy league and write everything down, everybody's players, every single stat, and then add up all the points.
Yeah, that would be hard.
It seems like there'd be a big temptation to cheat.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, but like I said earlier, the NFL just, you know, improved their stat system.
Yep.
So it also was a great time to start doing fantasy football
as well. Yeah, I would guess probably every team did added up the points for their team, the other person's team, or whoever they were playing, and had to make sure nobody was cheating, but...
Yeah, seriously. That's fun. So like I said, in 1964 is when those big TV deals came out. And that's kind of when this war between the AFL and the NFL really exploded. So before this, they were, you know, competing, obviously, but not as directly as they were going to compete in 1964 and onwards.
Right.
So, kind of going through the first few seasons of the AFL, I guess, just kind of a little bit of background. The AFL is a lot more open and exciting than the NFL, and part of that is because the NFL has this kind of tradition and ideas that are, you know, ingrained in how people play and coach and stuff.
Yeah, whereas I think, with the AFL, you can kind of look at the NFL and see what, you know, people like this, people don't really like this.
Exactly.
So, let's...
And it gives coaches a new platform to try, like, new ideas, new formations, new plays, all that kind of stuff, right?
And yeah, I think you see that with pretty much any expansion league ever. You know, the NBA had the ABA or whatever they brought in the three-point line. Yeah, the XFL tried all those crazy things.
Yep, exactly. And so the AFL, you know, people liked watching it because people, I mean, they would pass more in the AFL, which, I mean, even nowadays, people like passing more than running.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And the other thing about the AFL is that they were consistently signing rookies more than the NFL was. So the NFL and the AFL would draft about the same time of year. And then the AFL was signing a lot more rookies than the NFL was. Because the NFL kind of just thought that their pedigree would speak for themselves, right? It's like, oh yeah, the rookies don't want to play in this loser league, the AFL. So we'll just, you know, get around to sign them later. And then when they got around to it, it was too late.
Yeah.
Right? They would already be signed with the AFL. And it actually, the AFL was successful. I mean, the 1962 championship game in the AFL was broadcast to 56 million viewers, TV viewers, and it was a sellout crowd.
Wow.
It's also the longest game in professional history. It was a like game time, 77 minutes, 20 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, then that probably won't be... I doubt that'll be broken.
Yeah, it was double overtime.
Huh.
Right.
Because you can't tie in the championship game.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the only way this would be broken is if you had overtime in a playoff game.
Yeah.
Or championship.
Yeah, I mean, and how long do overtime games really last? You know what I mean? Not that long.
Yeah, exactly. Usually. And I mean, now they cut down the overtime periods to just 10 minutes.
Yeah.
In the NFL, so.
Yep. Something else big that happened in the AFL is... The Dallas Texans, so Lamar Hunt's team, moved to Kansas City. And that's after kind of competing with the Cowboys for those first, you know, 3 years.
Right.
Right. The Dallas Texans at the time were actually more competitive and like more people liked the Texans than the Cowboys, but they were both losing money. Like, they both lost upwards of $2 million in those first 3 years.
Right, because they were competing with each other there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so the Cowboys actually paid Lamar Hunt and the Texans $100,000 to move.
Huh.
Basically. Wow. Yeah, they're like, okay, you know, like, you got... And Lamar Hunt was happy to move because he knew that if he moved, he'd become more successful financially as well.
Yeah.
Right? It was a win-win. The Cowboys were happy to pay because they didn't want competition, you know, and so Lamar Hunt takes his team up to Kansas City and become the Chiefs.
Nice.
Also in 1963, the New York Titans were bought out by some new owners because the first owner was losing money. He couldn't afford it, basically. And they changed their name to the Jets, and then they start becoming more successful as well because the new owner was willing to spend money, advertise, give out tickets, all this kind of stuff to help promote them.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, like I said before, both leagues ended up, you know, signing these huge TV contracts. And kind of the biggest, I guess, when this started, this war started to take off was the signing of Joe Namath.
Nice. Yeah.
Who was one of my favorite characters in this time period.
Right.
He did a lot for the NFL-AFL merger. And we'll talk more about him, I guess, in the next episode when we talk about some of those early Super Bowls.
Yeah, Super Bowl III.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories of all time. You know, just a little...
Of course.
Little foreshadowing there.
Yeah.
So Joe Namath, right, he gets drafted by both the AFL and the NFL. He got drafted by the Jets in the NFL, or the AFL, sorry. And then the St. Louis Cardinals, so the Chicago Cardinals had moved to St. Louis by then. And the Cardinals, you know, basically offered him $200,000, a contract worth $200,000 total. And so he went to the Jets, and the Jets started the negotiations at $300,000.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
They ended negotiations... at $427,000.
Wow.
That's how much Joe Namath's rookie contract was worth when all was said and done.
Nice.
It's crazy. It's a ton of money, and it was a record-shattering rookie deal, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And he was the top talent in the draft by far too. So, yeah. You know, it was a huge win for whichever league got him.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of the contract that started this huge war, because at that point the NFL knew that they needed to start signing more rookies like Joe Namath, who they lost.
Uh-huh.
And the AFL wanted to keep signing him, of course, because they needed the name brand recognition. I mean, yeah. Joe Namath boosted attendance for the New York Jets by 18,000 people per game.
Wow.
In his first season. Like, he was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's
18,000. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's a huge difference. And so the NFL, you know, started upping their recruiting game for these rookies, basically. And they would send out these so-called babysitters to these potential rookies, right? And they would basically lock up these rookies in, like, hotel rooms and just keep them there until they are drafted and signed their contract, basically.
Wow.
Kind of maybe funny. A little bit unethical.
Just right? A little bit.
Because then these AFL representatives will, like, try and track these, you know, future rookies down, and they couldn't find them. When they did find out, like, oh, they're at this hotel, they couldn't get in, right? Because these babysitters would, you know, keep them completely out of contact, right? And so it really started to become this bidding war for these rookies' contracts, basically, right? Nice. I mean, we're talking one rookie got a contract for $850,000.
Wow.
Just a couple years after Joe Namath's 427. So it doubled, you know, Joe Namath's contract like 2 years. I mean, so these contracts are just spiraling out of control, and the owners are basically like, we can't keep this up. we're gonna lose all our money and go out of business if these contracts keep inflating at this rate, right? Yeah. At the end of the 1965 season, some of these owners decided that something needed to happen between these two leagues, or else everyone is going to end up going out of business.
Yeah.
And that is where we'll leave this podcast with, you know, people wondering what's going to happen between these two leagues.
Cliffhanger.
Exactly. But I am excited for the next episode, and I actually really like this episode. You know, these 5 years
there's a pretty lot that happened.
Pretty eventful.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So, yeah, it was a lot of fun talking with you guys. I really like it. NFL history is one of my favorite topics in general. So I really like talking about it. It's a lot of fun to research all this stuff and to, you know, just get together and hash it out.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it was fun.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Please subscribe, rate us 5 stars,
please.
Leave a review. We appreciate you all listening, and we will be back for the next episode.